Welcome back to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. Today's episode of the show is sponsored by our friends at Brooklady, the award-winning whiskey from Islay, who we have partnered with here at Hodinkee for the last couple of years. Stay tuned for an update later in the show on what we're up to this season. Hey, it's me, James Stacey, and I'm back for another episode of Hodinkee Radio. If you saw our previous episode, which was sort of a look back at 2024 with a Tantan and Malaika, we're repeating the format today, but I've got two new guests to chit-chat as sort of a retrospective of 2024, our favorite watches, the kind of big moments, things we remember, maybe some stuff we forgot, all that kind of stuff. So welcome to the show, editor and photographer Mark Kozlerich and editor Rich Forden. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. Yeah. Good. Thanks, James.
I think it makes sense to start kind of as broadly as possible here. In your mind, did 2024 have like a, this is the year of something, or was it kind of too varied? I found it to be kind of a surprising but varied year because, you know, we talked about this a bit on the previous, like, you know, we did start at what felt like kind of a lower note with a sort of subdued Watches and Wonders. But I actually think if you look back, this wasn't that quiet of a year in total. What are you guys feeling about it?
I think one of the questions on the list is about trends, which sort of overlaps with this one. But I found 2024 to be the year of like the non-standard, non-round, quote-unquote, shaped watch. And that is both in the pre-owned market, honestly, as well as the modern market reflecting some of the trends we've been seeing in that other pre-owned market lately.
Okay.
Which is interesting.
I was just gonna say, before we get too deep into it, because you know so much about the vintage side, is this something where the vintage side is actually pushing the modern watch idea forward? Like people got interested in vintage shape cases and that's why we're seeing modern ones? I mean, I guess that makes sense, but, and if so, what were the ones that, what are the real like trend makers on the vintage side of it?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it does feel like it to me, but I think my position is a bit biased there. You could dumb down things to say like, hey, look at this modern release. It dates back to this trend that started 3 years ago in vintage. Mm-hmm. This is a comp that they might not love, but I do think that the crash sort of popping 3-4 years ago is the exact reason why we have Bernerón in 2024. And that says nothing to diminish what Bernerón did, but there's a through line.
It's like
there.
A downstream thing.
For sure. There are other examples of that as well when you talk about minis and just differently shaped watches that brands had not been thinking about previously.
Yeah. And we talked a ton about even the Cartier effect of like they're having such a moment that it's actually bleeding out into other brands getting some shine for having a similar idea or a similar model. All really good watches. And certainly I think the crash to Bernerón is like a very direct sort of, not an homage, but it's a nod. It's a love letter to that idea for sure. Mark, what else kind of sits out for you, like maybe outside of the Cartier space? I mean, the shape case thing is definitely something that's here this year that was less prevalent last year.
I feel like this year was sort of the year of the slow burn when it came to like releases, just because I remember my, you know, fever dream sleep deprived induced hands-on with the Cartier Rewind that a lot of people read during Watches and Wonders. I feel like the response to that was sort of overall pretty negative. People were thinking like, what the heck, why do we need it? It's, you know, unnecessary, it's kind of silly or even stupid. But now in the last couple months, I've heard a lot of people talking about how amazing that watch is and how creative that watch is. And I think there's a lot of releases like that this year where I was going back through stories for things that we introduced that I think took a while for people to come around to. And I don't know if that's a reflection on the fact that the overall release pattern or how Watches and Wonders played out or whatever it may be was not so heavy hitting right away that people had to take some time and think about what came out this year and see if there was anything that they actually genuinely liked, because there weren't a lot of obvious mega releases. I think even stuff like Patek releasing white gold versions of watches that they had previously done in steel, like the denim strap thing wasn't really a denim strap, but I think now people are starting to come around to these things after looking at the state of what other people have released over the year, and are starting to realize that maybe not everything has to be a punch in the gut for it to be good.
I think it was a year that was largely characterized by really solid product, not just the wild stuff, but like on the previous ep with Tantan, we spoke about the White Dial Speedy. You almost universally loved the exact sort of watch that Omega should get into. And to be clear, we didn't get into this, but I'm really fascinated by the way that that brand is now using Daniel Craig as like a leaker, like a, you know, they give him a watch. He shows up at a party. People go nuts. We, you know, Mark, you shot him, you know, we saw him wearing a yet unreleased watch at the Olympics. I feel like he did it at least once a couple weeks ago again. And then now we have the watch. And guys, like a no date steel Seamaster, these watches look incredible. And I think they fit in really nicely with the Tudor, what we're all calling the monochrome. And I think like that genuinely entry level to like Omega had a pretty solid year as far as like product you can buy and enjoy. Sport watches.
Yeah, I think that's like the other trend I think of in 2024 as well, which is when I looked back on the releases, 2024 is sort of the year of fan service. When you think about the White Dial Speedy and the first Omega in space and the Seamasters that just come out, and that's just Omega.
Oh, yeah, the first Omega for sure, yeah.
The shaped stuff fits into that too, because it's like you're looking for that in the pre-owned market. Hey, here's this. Yep. It's a little bit different, but you already want it. And I always felt, in terms of new releases, as someone who pays so much attention to pre-owned and vintage stuff, that the brands just will never give you what you want, and it'll be this gap between here's what you want, this is what we're going to make. I think 2024 was like, the gap is here, or it might even be exactly what you want.
Yeah.
I do think that is a very interesting thing that Omega is doing. As you said, it's fan service. It's something really great to drive hype. I don't think they have too many more in the chamber before that gets already too old. I mean, we saw sort of the pushback a little bit on the no date Seamaster that he was spotted, and people were like, all right, you know, you did it once and it was fun. Second time, not so much. Third time now, we didn't cover it with the Sedna Gold. But at the same time, you look at the response that people had to those stories. And
so number one story of our year was the one you wrote of him wearing that that model at the Olympics. People, this is like, you know, we got a comment on a story we ran yesterday saying like, hey, could you guys write less about the moon swatch? And my reply to the comment was just, if you guys stop reading it, we'll stop writing it. Like, I don't know what to tell you. These are very, very popular stories. And Omega's genuinely in everyone's mind, especially when they, you know, when they really nail a product that people want and you can go out and get it. I think that's an important part. Tantan brought that up in the last chat, where people can get really excited about an Omega because there's a good chance you're not going to have to fight to get one. You might have to wait until they get a restock, but they're coming. It's not this like nebulous genie's wish sort of scenario like it can be with other brands.
This is not a shot at Rolex or Patek at all, because I still think they're making really great products. But that is something that I point out to a lot of people when they say like, oh, yeah, well, Rolex and Patek, they have to be the number one red stories for you guys at all times. And I think people are burned out on the idea of like something great being completely unattainable. You have to jump through hoops. You have to sort of massage an AD to figure out what the way to get them to be your friend and give you what you want. Omega went from saying we had so much demand for this watch that it could be, you know, a year before you could get the White Dial Speedmaster, to, hey, we ramped up production and now you can get it in a couple months. And it was a period of a couple weeks where they were very responsive to the demand and the interest. And, you know, they are making sure that people can get what they want. They're adjusting things accordingly. And to me, I think that's part of what makes that so great. The other thing that I wanted to highlight, when you said we were talking about how slow the year started out, I got a kick out of looking at the top stories for the year and realizing that the number one story to come out of Watches and Wonders was me writing about buying a moon swatch at the airport as I left Watches and Wonders. People are still excited about it. And as you said, if they didn't keep reading about it, we wouldn't keep writing about it, but people still want to hear about it.
Yeah. And look, I think that the interesting thing with Moonswatch, and I said this way too much on the previous outing, is it just proves how important it is to be able to have fun in this game. Like, don't get me wrong, there are collectors who are buying very needlepoint specific things for their collection, but most people are doing this just for the emotional response of being able to find the watch, maybe learn about it. Maybe you have to travel to get a Moonswatch or a Scuba 50 or something like that. But I think what we're actually capturing with that is how much maybe this whole hobby didn't feel that fun during the pandemic necessarily. Prices went through the roof. It felt like doors started to close on people. And then I think on the same, like almost in the same breath, you could say that, like, think about the Omega experience from a more generalist enthusiast, someone who loves watches, but maybe doesn't read about every new release, doesn't know about wait lists, and they go to a mall or whatever, and they go to the Rolex store, they go to whatever store, and they are told, like, well, we don't actually have anything. Let us, get on this wait list and we'll message you. Or, like, I don't even know what your inroad is anymore. You buy a two-tone Datejust, I'm not sure. And then they walk across the aisle to an Omega store and they see the White Dial Speedy and they're like, oh, maybe we don't have one today, but probably in the next 2 weeks, let us give you a call. I just think that's an experience that is going to ingratiate a lot of people to Omega.
And to add more context on the Moonswatch thing, I know it's super, super accessible for someone who's either just getting started, but, and Mark can probably speak to this as well, the collector you talk about who's laser focused and buying Pateks at a high level and maybe is like super into 3970s right now is leaving his house on a Sunday morning with a Moonswatch on. And they're the same buyer at that level, because at the end of the day, and I've talked about this before, I don't know where, but watch guys kind of want someone to come up to them in public and say, hey, man, nice watch. Like, at some level, that is why you're putting on a nice watch, whether you admit it to yourself or not. And maybe it's 1%, maybe it's 10%, but the Moonswatch creates the same conversation that a Cubidus does or a 3970 does. It is a signifier to those who know or those who care that you also know and care. And that's powerful at that price point, and that's why everyone's buying it.
And also, you think about, you want to get people into the space, and you say, like, okay, it starts conversations. I've talked to more people that have been wearing Moonswatches than any other watch that I've seen around. 50% of the time, they're like, oh no, this is the Omega Swatch. They don't know what they're wearing. They just liked it. They saw it. They bought it. But 50% of the time, it's either somebody that has other watches, like you said, and you can start up a larger conversation, or it's somebody that, I get a lot of messages from people saying, like, I want to buy my first watch. It's going to be a big purchase for me. What should I buy under $500? For us in this world that's all imaginary, points are, points don't matter, everything's made up, that kind of thing. Like, we're thinking 5 to 10, but for a lot of people, a big purchase is 500. And if the door opens at 500 and you get a Moonswatch, I'm not going to tell you that you're less of a watch person, because in 6 months, a year, maybe you're buying a Citizen Diver, maybe you're buying a Hamilton, and then the next thing, you're buying a Tudor, and you start reading more. And I think you want people to get excited. You want people to get into the space, or if they don't get into the space, to look down at their wrist and be happy that they bought something that makes them happy.
Absolutely.
And look, that's the Moonswatch.
Yeah,
for me.
I was literally about to say the same thing. Like, I think the Moonswatch, that whole program, and I would say Swatch in general, because you don't have to buy a Moonswatch or Scuba 50. They make a bunch of really cool, fun watches that don't cost that much money. And you can get into, and like, I do believe, like, you could go buy a neon Swatch and then go to your first Red Bar and have a pretty good time. And like, that's a like, for a world that is largely obsessed with money and that's a relatively low barrier to entry to go hang out. I think it's an interesting development in this world where we get two very different responses to the sort of Moonswatch Scuba 50 program, where certain folks in the industry don't like it because it cheapens something that they focused on, like whether that's a Speedy or a Blancpain or something like that. And I'm not convinced that it does cheapen anything, but that's the rhetoric. And then, but on the same time, like, think about how many people we've talked to in the last few years, like since 2021, that got into this because of that watch. It's just it's just such a solid gateway drug, especially in a world where you can't buy a 007 Seiko. You can't go out and buy an SNK Seiko for $90 like you used to be able to. Like, the math has kind of changed. And I think being able to have fun and enthusiasm and credibility within the enthusiast space at $500 or $300 is amazing.
I also think that leads into this idea of how to broaden your reach and your appeal without cheapening things. And I think that's another big trend for the year. You know, I'm sitting here with my Mad One.
Hey, there you go.
And I absolutely love this watch, but I think you see a lot of more high-end independent watchmakers start to navigate that question of how do we reach a broader audience without cheapening the product that we make. And I read an interesting interview with Theo Ofray. I think it was in Eclected Man. It did a really good job about talking about what he's been doing with his, you know, he's a young indie star making cool tourbillons and the kind of stuff high-end collectors want to do or want to pick up. And then he's also doing Space One. And that's somewhere between, I think, like $1,800 and $3,000 or something, depending on the model. He said in the interview, and I think this is exactly what Mad One has done for MB&F. I think it's what the Groenefelds tried to do recently as well, is figure out a way to reach a broader audience without cheapening your own name. And it's a hard thing to do, but it's a trend that I think is really picking up this year. And it makes me happy as somebody that I can't imagine that I'm going to buy a Tourbillon Apparee from Theo Ofray, as much as I love that watch. But now I can get a Space One. His name is associated with it. It's a completely different aesthetic.
They're really cool as well.
They're super cool. So I think that's another big trend that I hope continues on into the future, especially as the higher end of the market kind of quiets down a little bit. These brands are going to have to start navigating that. And
you look at the
financials for MB&F, and I think this is something like 30 or 40% of their income for the year is now Mad Ones, which does great things for the brand as well.
Again, special thanks to our partners at Brooklady for the support of Hodinkee Radio. This holiday season, we've partnered with Brooklady on a special giveaway that you can learn all about in the link in the article below or in the notes for this episode. You might be surprised at what you see, and you most definitely don't want to miss it. And now, back to the show. So I'm going to give you guys a choose your own adventure. I think we'll get to both of these, but you guys can pick where we go next. You guys want to hit Cubitus or you want to hit Tudor?
Mark, I never liked Goosebumps, so you go ahead and pick our path.
Oh, man. Let's start with Cubitus, and I think we'll probably keep
it
relatively short. It was a huge moment. It's hard to figure what hasn't already been said, but we can do that.
I would say, definitely defer to Ben's story. He wrote it from the perspective of someone who actually buys Pateks, which I think is important. You know, I have a dilettante's, you know, perspective on it from 50 yards away. I'm looking through the glass at the boutique, and I'll kick it off. I don't really understand the extreme negativity, but I assume that's not coming from people who are going to buy the watch. And obviously that's been largely the tenor of the feedback from Patek as well. I don't have a problem. I would say most brands' watches I don't like. Every brand here or there has watches I really like, but I'm not like a brand guy. I don't think Cubitus wasn't the first watch that Patek makes that I don't think was for me, right? You know, if that makes any sense. But I don't find the watch like offensive or that strange, especially not downstream of an increased interest in watches that aren't round. The need for the brand, their self-imposed need to move beyond the 5711. I think all of this kind of makes sense. I think we'll have to wait a year or two to really understand if the model was successful from Patek's standpoint. But I think as far as a brand like Patek being able to create a moment for themselves, I don't think they could have done much better, weirdly, than they did with the Cubitus.
Stir the pot a bit for you, boil you up a bit more. Does it make you any more upset that Patek both discontinued your favorite watch, the 5164A,
which was also this year. Yeah,
and then comes out with the Cubitus? Does that brand positioning make you any more concerned?
I mean, look, again, I can only speak from like video game bucks, if you will. I was not in the market for either of these. I know Mark is also. I think we share our extreme love of the 5164A, but there's also like a lot of them. They made them for a long time. So if you really want one of those, you can probably, it might even be easier to get a 5164A than a Cubitus, probably quite a bit easier. depending on who you're calling.
I don't know that's true, but I'll touch on that in a second. Sorry.
Oh, okay, cool. I to attempt to answer that question, I don't even think like that, just because I'm so far from being like a Patek buyer. None of it's real. The 5164A, I think, is just an evolution of a twin time Patek lineage that I really love, that dates back to the 50s. And there's something about that that I adore. I think I might have a different opinion on the Cubitus if I was in love with the Nautilus. And I like the Nautilus. I have nothing against it, but I'm an Aquanaut guy, I think, deep down. Like if it was my credit card hitting the table, it'd be probably for an Aquanaut. I like the idea of a Patek on a rubber strap if you're going up for a sporty Patek. Otherwise, like, yeah, I 3940 or something like that would absolutely curry my favor. But I think that's where I probably land. I feel so much more strongly about the Aquanaut than the Nautilus that I don't really feel like the Cubitus just adds. It doesn't seem to take anything away in my mind, which is, yeah, again, I don't fully understand the negativity parts of it for sure. And especially the part that's coming from like actual collectors that feel like they're not getting what they want from a brand. And that's not a problem unique to Patek at all. That's how all brands have to deal with their best clients. They're also the ones that know the most, typically. And I think you do have to make them happy. And time will tell if this watch is one that makes their clients happy.
In terms of negativity, this is Patek experiencing what like every single brand on our site experiences when they release a brand or a new watch. Like Nivida Gretchen releases a new GMT. It's 36 millimeters. So many people commenting, if it was only 38, if it was only 37, like this is unique, not to Patek. It's across the industry. It just is so much more heightened when it's Patek's first watch in 25 years. Like,
yeah, well, it is like I saw someone compare it to like waiting for a band to drop an album, and you really want the album to be similar to the one that came out 20 years ago, but how could it be? It's not 20, like a lot has changed. The band is older. Everything's different. And I think like we see a little bit of that in the Cubitus, where it's a bit of a, you know, a fifth album from a brand that you love, and it's a new sound. And sometimes that, like, I can list brands where I liked the new sound eventually, and I list other where like I only like their first three albums or whatever. And I think that's what Patek's dealing with. And I agree, what they're dealing with may be novel to them because they don't release watches that often, but it's not novel to the watch world at all. They're just getting what most brands get when they drop stuff. That's a good, great, great perspective.
Like you say, the audience has been waiting 25 years for this, but also Patek has sort of iterated on designs and stuff close to home for that amount of time. And so it's not, I don't think anybody after 25 years would necessarily knock it out of the park the first time. I think the accessibility thing is an interesting thing. I think the question of whether or not we're going to see them discontinue all steel Nautilus next year, you know, the 5990, the 5712s, like, are they going to pull those just to put more pressure on consumers to buy the Cubitus? I don't think they're having any trouble getting people to buy the Cubitus, but I'm also hearing from people that have not been offered a Nautilus, have not been offered an Aquanaut, that they're being offered a Cubitus. It seems like maybe Patek is putting more production into that model to drive that model and drive customers towards that model. I've been in a number of places that retail Patek over the last couple of weeks and seen that customers are seeing the Cubitus every single time I walk in. You've got customers sitting down and handling them, and they've got models there for people, and they seem to be taking orders and registering interest, which they wouldn't be doing on a Nautilus. So I think, you know, there's a bigger strategy with how Patek is going to be rolling this out. And as you said, it'll take a year or two to figure out what that strategy is, just for that model, but also for the brand in general, the changes that they might make to sort of make the Cubitus more of a success, or at least more ubiquitous. My only feedback is the same things that everybody else has said, which is it just, to me, doesn't look as thoughtfully designed as some things in the past. And part of that is the size. I've tried on two of the three models. They do wear quite large. They are quite flat. I think this is what happens when you make a big square watch. I think the other thing to think about too is what it will look like on the secondary market when things cool down. I don't think it'll go below retail, but when you look at stuff like 5270s and the things that we as watch lovers look up to and want to have, the fact that those sell below retail and stuff like the Cubitus is so much above retail or the Nautilus or these other things is still surprising to me. So I think that will be a curious thing to watch as well over the next year or two.
Yeah, look, I think a lot of this is pointing towards some unknowns about Patek's strategy. I think that the Cubitus could mean that Watches and Wonders might be wild, but we are going to do a couple episodes on 2025, so let's hold off on that line specifically. Let's get to a favorite of mine, who I think had like a sneakily strange and successful year of changing how they speak to the audience and the wider world, and that's Tudor. So we kind of kicked off the year with some really solid consumer product. That's the BB58 GMT, and certainly the what we're calling the monochrome, the nicely made update to the current 41 millimeter Black Bay. But then we saw multiple, you know, unique dial variations for the Formula One. They did Miami and Las Vegas. We also saw the pink dial. We saw the blue boutique edition. And then, of course, we have our first Pelagos that like isn't even a dive watch. So the brand's like actively trying new stuff, including making models that people can't buy. They still have this very strong connection with cycling. What do you think of the Tudor strategy? You know, I think a lot of times, myself included, as a huge fan of the brand, you focus on these tiny boxes that maybe aren't perfect for you. Like BB58 GMT comes out and it's in a Coke colorway with gilt, and you go, well, you know, if it wasn't gilt, I'd buy it. If it wasn't, you know, if it was Pepsi instead of Coke, I'd buy it. If it was black, and like, you know, there's all that kind of discussion. But if we go a layer beyond that, what do you think of the year for Tudor? Because I think that we saw kind of a new playbook or a new page in the playbook.
Yeah, I mean, I think the product is super interesting, but the other thing that goes with it is a lot of brands do the, you know, Watches and Wonders release, dump a bunch of product on you, kind of a deluge that you have trouble to process, and then wait 6 months until two or three fall releases. I think it's much more exciting to have these things rolled out slowly over the course of, you know, here's one, and then 2 months later, there's another one, and then a month later, there's one that's kind of niche, but it's fun. And, you know, the Inter Milan Black Bay 58, which is not everybody's favorite, but they're doing stuff like that. And that was available largely for people that wanted them for a short amount of time. And I think that's a more fun way to engage with consumers. It does make it a little hard to, if you're the kind of person that like me has to save up for a watch and see what's coming out and decide what you want and be able to make some decisions and not worry that you're going to have a better watch come out in 2 months. But it at least keeps the excitement going and keeps you surprised at what the future might hold. And I think that's really good for the community at large.
I think the playbook is new and it's interesting to follow it from our viewpoint, and it feels new. But what they're doing is very core to the Tudor brand sort of goal and ethos, which is, I can remember I walked into a Tudor boutique in Chicago 5 years ago that I was at AD that stocks Tudor, just to correct myself, but they had stocked all of Tudor's line. And that was a really eye-opening experience to me because I had seen Tudor through the lens of the relaunch in the United States and the Hodinkee lens, which is like the Black Bays of the world, the Black Bay 58s of the world. Then you see the whole catalog and you're like, oh, they make something for everyone. Their whole catalog is a commercial product brand. And they relaunched by creating interesting models for the enthusiasts to layer on top of that commercial product catalog. Now they're treating those enthusiast watches the same way they treat the rest of their catalog, which is like, hey, we're here for you and we're going to offer you everything that you want eventually. Like, just wait for us to build out this catalog. It's not just the 58. It's not just one Pelagos. Now we have five. Now we have the 54. Like, it's just the expansion of the catalog in the same way that the rest of the catalog spoke to, like, just to dumb it down a bit, like that elevated mall watch buyer.
Yeah,
sorry.
For sure. I think everything you said is almost directly proven by that monochrome, the 2024.
Right. That was the tip. That was like, this is what we're doing.
They started in 2012 and they've just been progressively iterating. And now they've essentially locked in on their take on a modern sub. And it's this deeply conventional, but they've checked every box. You get T-fit, you get a great bracelet, You've got the Loom, you've got a great bezel. It's a great looking watch. It wears really well. They've obviously locked in on a movement strategy that's much different than 12 years ago. I think it's been a fascinating sort of time for the brand. And, you know, we've only got a couple minutes left here, and there's so much to talk about from this year. Obviously, we did some great stuff with Hodinkee and with like the UBS House of Craft. The other big story, which I think will play out obviously more next year, and I'm very excited to get into it in parts 3 and 4 of this little December year-end series, is TAG and LVMH taking F1. I think this is like, it was a big story when it came out, but I think we don't even understand how big it will be. We don't know what the execution of that stuff is going to be. Admittedly, this is just a bit of a teaser for parts 3 and 4. But I will have Rich and Mark on to talk about the future of this sort of stuff. But why don't we wrap it up with, like, if you've got one or two quickly, favorite watches of the year. Anything stand out? Anything you bought that you love? That's usually a pretty good metric. For me, like, I'd go Doxa Sub 200s way up there for something I could afford. Mark wrote about a Grubo Force Fortillon and the EMC SR71. Those are probably my two favorite, like, no budget, cool new things that came out this year. How about you guys? What landed on the radar, whether it's something in reality or something you just kind of dream about?
The Grubel is definitely on my list too. I mean, the watch blew my mind. I think your photos did a great job as well, Mark. Like, it's very hard to take a small-ish watch and have the time that's spent on the movement come through in a photo, and I thought that was really great. But in terms of watches that stand out to me, a watch I purchased this year at the very low end of the market is an Impossible Watch Co. Malachite dial.
Oh, cool.
It's just a simple, like, time-only watch made by one guy in Tolkien, Alaska, using imported Chinese parts. But these stone dials are really, really crazy. I always like to shout him out because I do wear that watch a lot, and it's, you can spend $700 in way worse ways. And at the other end of the spectrum, I think Laurent Ferrier had a great year. If we were talking about trends, and the Classic Moon is probably my favorite watch of the year. Totally biased. I love the brand. I love the aesthetic, but I think they knocked it out of the park and signaled a new direction going forward for that brand that I think is going to be really cool. So I'll call that one out as one of my favorite watches of the year.
I love it. I love the mix there. That stone dial brand. We'll put that in the show notes. I believe you showed me an early one. I'm not sure if it was the one that you have or not. And then I think it was also in one of our staff picks, and just a really, really cool watch. I love seeing that type of, like, taking something that's not really part of the micro brand space usually, whether it's a shaped case or a very cool dial, usually it's sport watches. And I love that we're now seeing that micro brand space, that sub $1,000 category, like, really branch out into taking the format that used to give people sport watches that they couldn't buy for a reasonable price. And now we're getting dress watches that you can buy for a reasonable price and very interesting designs and that sort of thing. So good call out on that one. How about you, Mark? What one or two kind of stood out for you?
You know, the one that has gotten the most wrist time, and I'm lucky that I won the lottery while I was in Geneva, and they had a few watches available at the time. So I apologize to everybody that's still waiting on delivery of the Mad Wand, but I've been wearing this a lot, so much so that I end up trying to spin my GMT when I put my GMT on. I'm used to that feeling of the rotor going, and so it just becomes like a fidget spinner kind of thing. But it doesn't work when you're using a normal watch, and I'm worried that maybe I'm actually damaging some of my other watches that are not meant to spin like that. But I love the Mad One. I also love the reaction that people get when I am showing them the new Slim for the first time. I wore it in Singapore, and MBNF was there. Most of their, you know, commercial team was there. Max was there. They didn't bring one because they were all allocated, but people still wanted to see it so much that I ended up just basically handing it over to the team for the weekend just so they could show it to everybody. And people got such a kick out of it. And it is, again, one of my favorite watches that they've done. I think it's amazing that they're making it slightly more accessible, not as much as the Impossible Watch Co. stuff, but still, like, very nice from a brand that is making things starting at $50,000 or $60,000 generally. The Grubel was just incredible. The Laurent Ferrier releases were on my list as well. The the classic sandstone auto was a little bit high priced as a limited edition, and it wasn't one of their natural escapement watches, which is kind of what I would think about going for if I was buying a Laurent Ferrier, but still two really great releases this year. You know, I have a soft spot for this in a lot of ways, but from the high end, the John Mayer Royal Oak was just a big moment.
Which also like does mark that 5134, but like the 2120, 2800, the end of that generation. And that does kind of tease, because some eventually we'll see something new for QPs from them. That could be part of the 2025 conversation, that sort of thing. But I agree, it's a moment as a complete nerd for the first generation of that movement in a Royal Oak back in the 80s. It's something to see them end that movement entirely.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, selfishly for us at Hodinkee, where we've had John sort of be a part of our family for a while, it's fun to see him finally have something that speaks to the higher end collector that he's been for such a long time, and a lot of thought that went into it. It's a really cool watch. Not at the super low end, but the other one that I wanted to call out that I think is just a great buy, and at some point I'm going to have to get it, the Grand Seiko SLGW003. Their manual wind high beat, white birch dial, their brilliant hard titanium case, which they've used, I think now it's three times or something, including with the Kodo, super high polished titanium, really cool watch, really great wind to it. I think one of the best watches of the year. I would have, for GPHG Academy, I put it, you know, pretty much at the top for whatever I could put it for, just because I love that watch so much. And it just highlights, like, not everything, as I was saying before, not everything has to be a gut punch to be a solid watch that maybe flew under the radar, but it's a great watch. And I think like a great representation of what the year has been for a lot of brands.
I don't disagree at all. I think it was a year largely categorized, like we talked about, by conventional product that brands actually wanted to sell to a wide market of people who knew what they were buying. But I also think we're at the end of this episode. This has been an absolute treat, guys. I love doing these sort of retrospective looks back at the year. It's kind of a fun thing. It's always one of my highlights of December. And to sit down with you guys and chit-chat from, I mean, we really covered some bases here, so I really appreciate it. But Mark and Rich, thanks so much for joining me. And I can't wait to chat 2025 with you guys in the next couple weeks.